board the aircraft when it was intercepted by RAF fighter jets. It's understood the captain told air traffic control of disruptive passengers. Omari Nauman was one of those on board.
They tried to come into the cockpit, I think, a few times, and because they'd been asked not to do that, they got into an argument with the crew and made a few threats, which is the cabin crew and everyone that was sitting around, and two people that have been arrested. This is what they've related to the passengers on board.
The family of the soldier murdered in Woolwich says he lived his dream serving in the army. Drummer Lee Rigby's relatives have spoken publicly at their request for the first time since he died on Wednesday afternoon. They described him as a hero who was a devoted father. His stepfather Ian Rigby read out a note from his sisters Courtney and Amy.
Rest in peace, Lee. We loved you so much and you didn't deserve this. You fought for your country and did it well. You will always be our hero. We are just upset you left us so early. We love you, Lee. Good night.
A van driver has admitted the manslaughter of a mother of three in a hit-and-run in Cardiff last October that left up to a dozen others injured. But Matthew Tverden denies her murder. Prosecutors will now decide whether he should face trial. Four footballers have been cleared of sexually assaulting a woman in a hotel room. Anton Rogers, Lewis Dunk, George Barker and Steve Cook were also found not guilty of voyeurism. Sally Berko has agreed a settlement with Lord McAlpine over a message she posted on Twitter. The High Court has ruled the tweet about the former Tory treasurer was libelous. That's the latest. I'm Jenny Lyne.
BCFM 93.2, the Bristol station you can count on.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. They want you to forget, we want you to remember. So helping us review this week's news is the city's first Independence for Bristol councillor, elected for King's Weston earlier this month, that's Jason Budd. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, the murder of young soldier in civvies Lee Rigby lured police to the scene. The murderers did and tried to kill them too. But how did they know who he was and where he was going? How long had two of Britain's top Islamist suspects been watching him for? And who gave them a gun and ammunition? Plus, the world's first Bilderberg Fringe Festival takes place this year. Source of most of our war and money woes, the NATO zone mafia come to Hertfordshire on the second weekend in June. People will be there too. That's you and I. And the latest on that and tomorrow's warm-up party in London. I'm joined by one of the organisers of the not-to-be-missed Counter Conference. And former Bank of Canada Governor Mark Carney is due to take over at the Bank of England soon. We look at the other bank he works for and find out it's much more powerful than a puny little Canadian bank. Plus, a new river bus service for the people, by the people. After the bankruptcy of the Bristol Ferry Boat Company, we talked to Keith Hallett, one of the people behind the new venture. More problems at accident and emergency this week, as well as a lack of health service accountability. Daphne Havercroft from South West Whistleblowers Health Action Group is in. And Martin Summers takes us on his weekly tour of the world's non-Woolwich hotspots, all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 5 Celsius and some light rain. This weekend, highs of 16, fairly sunny weekend. Highs of 20 degrees Celsius next week, some showers at the beginning of the week, sunnier and warmer towards the end of the week. Next weekend, that's the 1st and 2nd of June, highs of 16, fairly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is the city's first Independence for Bristol councillor, elected for King's Weston earlier this month. That's Jason Budd. Hi, Jason. Welcome to Drive Time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, first of all, Jason, how did you get elected? Because you come as a rank outsider, suddenly popped in there at the top in King's Weston. How did you do it?
First past the post system, so I got more votes than the other candidates within there. I think I had a very compelling story as I was a local boy. I grew up in the area and I've always lived in the area. And I was talking about issues that were to do specifically with King's Weston, wanting to champion those rather than having some party political line that I wanted to take over the rest of the city's views.
Well, it's quite good coming in. Had you stood in that part of the city ever before?
No.
Well, so you came as a complete outsider. Who was the former councillor there then?
There was a Liberal Democrat councillor, Simon Rayner, who was standing down.
Okay.
And a new Liberal Democrat candidate was standing, and there was also a Labour candidate standing, and they came second and third, respectively.
So are you a kind of a little side shoot off of the Mayor, George Ferguson, as another independent?
Would you define yourself
as sort of being non-party political, wanting nothing to do with party politics?
I think we want nothing to do with national party politics. We are not necessarily an offshoot, but we're probably part of the same change that's happening to democracy generally, where people are looking for something different and looking for a change, a different way of doing things.
Okay, so tell us about you. What's your background, professional? What's your day job?
My day job is I work for an events management company in the city centre. I'm also involved with different charities and voluntary groups. I was involved with the referendum campaign for the mayor, the A Mayor for Bristol campaign, and that's really kind of where I felt a responsibility to come into local politics more, was because I actually thought that the directly elected mayor was a better thing as a way to run local government, but it changed the role of what a local councillor was, rather than having a mini Westminster model where we were trying to have the most possible number of councillors in the chamber so that you could form a government.
But it's a dictatorship, isn't it? You've got a whole load of people at the top. You've got a whole load of people at the top in the cabinet.
Yes.
They can vote, but the mayor can just totally override them.
Well, that's something that's happened very recently. It's not a dictatorship because obviously you can vote for the person and then vote it the next election. So it's a little bit difficult when you have places like Syria that are under a real dictatorship to use that kind of terminology. What it is a very strong leadership position which provides strategic oversight for the municipal area for a set governmental period. In this case, it's going to be 3.5 years. Next time, it will be 4 years, and people will have their choice to vote again then.
But the old system represents all views. All views are in there making those decisions, aren't they? So it's not just one person.
It's all views. It's views represented by the governing group of councillors within the council that then elect a leader, which is a distilled down version of it. This was the first time the people of Bristol directly voted in the leader of the council. I think that's a better description of democracy than what we had first time.
Okay, back to you again, though, because you do an events management. Give us an idea of a couple of events that you're working on or have done recently.
I work in a venue in Bristol City Centre, so we tend to do things inside of there, which...
Where? Which venue?
Armada House Conferences and Events.
Okay.
I didn't want to give a commercial plug. I didn't know whether I was allowed to do that or not. And I've also worked with the Bristol Festival of Nature.
By the old telephone exchange.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. And the council uses that building, so you must have with the council over the time. I mean, I've been to planning meetings and things there.
We have the BRT inquiry was held there. Yeah. So there we work with the council as well as private companies as well.
And what about your other stuff? You're saying you're involved in sort of quite a lot of other voluntary type activity.
Yeah, I'm a member of the Bristol Junior Chamber of Commerce. I was a council management member for them last year, do different initiatives around the city. Most famously helped to set up the Balloon Fiesta in the city. We helped to run the Bristol Young Student of the Year Awards last year, which was about designing an app that was then going to be commercialised. Worked with the Ideas Festival, lots of different arenas.
Have you ever been a member of a political party?
Yes, I was a member of the Liberal Democrats.
Okay, but then you usurped another Liberal Democrat. It's a bit like George, isn't it? You know, he was also a long time member of the Liberal Democrats. It looks to me as if the Lib Dems, I hate to be cynical, but the Lib Dems have realised that they're going to get an absolute pasting at the next election. Quite a lot of you have decided, we've had enough of that, let's pretend we're independents.
I wouldn't characterise it like that, as you can imagine.
Well, isn't Nick Clegg a human shield for the coalition government, for the Conservatives?
Again, in terms of my personal story, I became a Liberal Democrat because it was the 2010 general election, and I thought the Liberal Democrat candidate was the best. Since that time, I have been active in things to do with local politics, and the referendum was one of those. There was big differences of opinion within the Liberal Democrats locally about that question, and not dissimilarly to how George became a Liberal councillor in the 1970s, and then it was only after he had been in the post for several months that they realised that he wasn't actually a member of the party. I've always kind of seen myself as someone who was more of an independently minded person who was interested in kind of doing things locally, who happened to be a Liberal Democrat, and I think maybe people like that have realise there's a different way of doing things. I don't think there's any kind of anything more insidious about it than that.
What about as a wider political vision, though? Because this is at least one of the things with the other major parties, is that they do have some kind of vision. At least they say they do.
Yes.
What about you as independents? The criticism is that, you know, you're just going issue by issue. You've got no real coordinated policy. And in fact, sometimes independents will be voting against each other.
Yes.
So people don't know what they're getting when they're voting.
Well,
for you.
I think independents voting against each other would be very welcome, actually, because we've had very robust discussions between members in the group about specific issues. I'm the only one in the chamber who would vote, but certainly if there were to be another independent in there, there would be no whip, so that wouldn't be enforced to vote on certain issues in different ways. We would just be interested in all views being heard. There is a commonality between Independents for Bristol in that we all share certain standards of personal integrity that we must sign up to, which are referred to as
You're all ex-members of the Lib Dems?
No, we're not. No, come from all parties and none, actually. Some people have a Labour Party background, some people with the Green Party, and the vast majority of people have actually had no party affiliation beforehand.
Okay, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. Martin, first, before we talk about this whole idea of having independent councillors, the IMF have been in the UK this week and have delivered their verdict. Basically, George Osborne's got to change course. First of all, why have they given that verdict, do you think? I know you're a big critic of Osborne anyway, but now the IMF are here, are they going to have to listen to him?
Well, let's get this straight. The IMF are not right about everything all the time. They may be right in this case, but it's like a clock that's stopped. It's right twice a day. I'm not a great fan of the IMF, and I don't particularly take much notice of what they say. But of course George Osborne is, so it hurts when they tell him you're cutting too far too fast. I think it matters to him, but of course he's now locked himself in. If the coalition government had been less dogmatic, they could change course at this point without any loss of face. But now they find it difficult to do.
But is he actually going to take any notice? These are the heavyweights.
He's made it clear he's not going to. And of course the real danger is that we will then, you know, we're in a deflationary environment which is pushing towards a crash. I mean, the stock markets all over the world have reached highs on paper that they haven't reached since before the crash. Meanwhile, the economy in Britain and elsewhere is turning down, and that in fact is real danger. I mean, the whole point of putting quantitative easing and so on was to boost the stock market up with the hopes that that would then filter through into the real economy, and the real economy would pick up, and then they could stop the quantitative easing. The real danger now is that the quantitative easing leads to a situation where the stock market is going up, the economy is going down, and then you're going to have a catastrophic crash with no safety net.
Well, the IMF are telling George Osborne, Christine Lagarde, to ease the pace of austerity, and they're giving very good reasons for that. They're saying that if you don't, you're just going to end up with hardly any economic activity, no tax coming in, and the economy's going to really tank.
And the other thing is that the deficit will go through the roof. This is the problem. I mean, basically, what the Labour front bench have been saying about this has been proved to be right, effectively, that if you go too far, too fast at this, you don't actually solve your problem with the deficit, and you're actually running the risk of crashing the economy, and that's exactly where we're at.
Also, quantitative easing. There's some analysis this week on Newsnight, very good actually, saying that the quantitative easing actually is, none of it is finding its way into the real economy. Actually, what's happened is because we've had the highest FTSE index for a long time. I don't know if it's forever or whatever, but it's extremely high this week. It does look like this quantitative easing money is all going in to essentially the casino end of the investment market, and very, very little of it is actually finding its way into the real world. So what are the implications of many of the businesses that are actually foundering finding that their share price is actually going up? It's bizarre.
Well, what it is that stock markets are out of line with real economic conditions, and that is a potential for a crash. Eventually, one morning, they wake up and have a panic. I mean, because the Japanese suddenly found that their bond, their interest rates are starting to creep up. And the real danger is that the quantitative easing and so on that we've been doing over the last 3 or 4 years leads to a massive bubble, which is what's happening in the stock markets, which will go pop, and then we really will be in trouble.
Okay, so why isn't that money finding its way into the real economy?
Because it doesn't. Basically, asset prices go up, and they're not in any. It's, but what they really need to do is put money in people's pockets. giving money to the speculators.
So what you're saying, is that these companies, businesses, buildings, etc., that they own, are being inflated in value. So they're saying this is worth this much when it isn't actually really worth that much.
Correct.
Okay. Okay, on this on the business of the Independence for Bristol, we've got Jason in here. There's a clear sign, Martin, that the voters are fed up with the party political system, with party politics, particularly the fact that a lot of these there's a lot of weight, it seems, from Westminster onto and outside Bristol onto the local political parties. Isn't it? Aren't you actually now sitting here a bit of a dinosaur being part of the Labour Party? Because this is a new move, isn't it? We've had this. I mean, Jason has come from nowhere, right, to take this seat, which is quite an achievement, actually, and. And so is George, really. He's is taking over as mayor. So aren't the major political parties, the three main parties anyway, Labour, Conservative and Lib Dem in the city, aren't they potentially anyway history?
No, I think that's just exaggerated. Don't forget that George won, but we came second, and on another day we might have won, next time maybe we will. The Labour Party is not dead. We've had a lot of. We were in government for 13 years, and of course, a lot of things were done. For example, there wasn't enough done to reform the financial system, which is why we're in the mess we're in. And I was critical of that at the time, and so were many Labour Party.
But can't you see the tide is turning against party politics, at least in Bristol, certainly?
Well, I don't think there's a problem with that. I mean, you know, but what I would say to Justin,
Jason,
is are you a left-wing independent or a right-wing independent? Because as you vote and as things develop, you will take positions on things, and we will judge you by those positions. And I'm quite sure. I think what's interesting in Bristol is that George has gone for a kind of consensual style and bringing everybody in, and I think that's quite difficult to do. And I think he's done a very good job of doing it. I think what's made it work is because the Conservatives have been willing to compromise, and you know they have, you know they're not dogmatic in Bristol, the leadership, and I think that's not the case in the rest of the country. So I think that's what makes, you know, and there's a premium in Bristol, and I think Jason will agree with me. There's a premium here on being constructive. I mean, people are expected to be constructive.
We've got a little clip to listen to now, and that's from King Mervyn. Now, Mervyn King, I love to call him King Mervyn because he does sort of sit there as if he's... Sorry?
The outgoing
Governor of the Bank of England. Before we hear from him, this is one of his last talks because he's being replaced next month by Mark Carney. Martin, tell us a bit about Mark Carney.
Well, I don't know a huge amount about him before he became, appointed. I mean, obviously, I've read about him since.
Well, Goldman Sachs, for a start. You know, he's Goldman Sachs.
All of these people are sort of Goldman Sachs-type people. I mean, you don't central bank if
We've got Goldman Sachs, at least they were, anyway, running Italy. We've got them in Spain. We've got many of the countries that aren't in Greece, for example. Ex-Goldman Sachs people are these technocratic leaders of these countries now. It doesn't really sound that democratic, and now Britain is going to have one too.
Well, I think when we were talking about party politics being irrelevant, this is the nub of the matter, because a lot of policies are no longer decided by elected politicians. They're either decided by central bankers who are actually in hoc to financial interests. It's a revolving door. And that's why it's very difficult for parties or even independents to do what they would like to do. I mean, basically, the Bristol, with its all-party government, has got to carry out the same savage cuts as everybody else. And really, we're going to be arguing about what to cut, which, of course, doesn't enthuse people, either as politicians or as voters.
Yeah, sure. I think there's an interesting parallel with what was happening with Mario Monti, where he was essentially installed as the president but had a parliamentary elected under him democratically. I don't think that's necessarily a good model to follow, but I think that's also a sign of these strange changing times that we're in, where we are seeing a blend of technocracy, as I'm calling it, and democratic representation, and that is a potentially dangerous situation.
Well, the way I see it, I mean, you know, back in medieval times, it was the king and the pope were sort of competing for the soul of the nation. Now it seems to be the bank and the politicians in some way, you know, putting different agendas. But certainly the banks seem to be, you know, in the driving seat, actually, because there's very little, it seems, intervention by the Treasury. Well, there's little intervention by the Treasury on these state-owned banks. Anyway, before I gabble on too much, let's hear Mervyn and one of his last little pronouncements. Try not to fall asleep as you hear him.
There is a welcome change in the economic outlook. Today's projections are for growth to be a little stronger and inflation a little weaker than we expected 3 months ago. That's the first time I've been able to say that since before the financial crisis. But this is no time to be complacent. We must press on to ensure a recovery and to bring down unemployment. Our economy still faces the challenge of a substantial rebalancing following the abrupt reassessment of future incomes and spending opportunities triggered by the crisis. This hasn't been a typical recession, and it won't be a typical recovery. Nevertheless, a recovery is in sight. Output grew by 0.3% in the first quarter, and growth is likely to strengthen over the course of the year. The committee's overall judgment about the outlook for four-quarter GDP growth is summarised in chart 1 on page 6.
I think we can leave him there. Yes, chart 1.
No good.
But he's he's apart from sort of sending people to sleep there. He's saying the recovery is in sight. Now, he's been saying that actually over about the last 2 or 3 years. He keeps saying it's in sight, but there's headwinds. Unfortunately, the winds are blowing the ship away from the recovery, and he uses these kind of weird nautical analogies.
Well, don't forget, his job as the head of the Bank of England is to say that the recovery's in sight. If he went out there and said anything else, the markets would panic. So you've got to take that with a pinch of salt. I don't think there is a recovery in sight, actually. I think the situation is actually really, really dangerous. I think we certainly need a plan B.
Jason,
any worse.
As someone that's entering politics in the city, don't you think your hands are really rather tied by all these financial constraints, and you spend most of your time wrestling with, OK, which is going to be the least devastating thing we're going to have to cut this year?
I think it's a relatively good way of putting it. It's a process that you go through when you become newly elected, that you're obviously orientated and trained into the various processes of the council, and it's quite illuminating and frightening in a way to realise how limited your powers are as a local councillor and a local government to take charge of your own city. That was part of what the Mayor's Conference was about, that what is local government for when we have so much centralised power and so many of our options are judged by Whitehall.
Mark Carney, this guy that's been coming in to take over from Mervyn, it would be very different having him, I suppose, a slightly different form of soporific speech you'll be giving.
That would be soporific, that's what central bank governors are supposed to be.
But just to point out, he is actually also from this Bank for International Settlements over in Switzerland. Switzerland is a funny country, you know, world wars happen around it, they sit on their mountains, they watch, you know, tanks fighting in years gone by. They're not part of the UN, they're not part of the EU, and yet it's where it all happens, it seems. And the Bank for International Settlements is in Basel, in Switzerland. It was set up originally after World War One to administer the reparations for the war reparations for Germany. But in the 1930s, it was being used to actually finance the Nazi Party and finance Hitler's rise to power. After Second World War, at the Bretton Woods Conference, they agreed at a vote agreed to close it. But it's still there. For many years, it was in Basel, opposite the railway station. Above a chocolate shop with an anonymous office, and about 10-15 years ago they had a massive tower built in Basel called the Tower of Basel, which is the bank, and this is where the central bankers all get together to set policy. So when Jason and anybody else in politics in Britain is trying to decide economic policy, they're up against these guys basically, who are meeting secretly in Basel and actually deciding on their own policies amongst themselves. And Mark Carney's one of the people from the BIS. I mean, Martin, this doesn't really sound very democratic a way to run economics and to run money, does it?
No. Of course it isn't. I mean, that's the fundamental problem, which we're both putting our finger on. If things like, if groups like that, the Basel, you know, the international settlements in Basel, or the IMF, and of course Goldman Sachs are massively over-leveraged. I've been reading about Goldman Sachs. You know, they classified themselves as a bank in order to receive TARP funds in 2008, but their asset to leverage ratio is in the thousands. A standard bank lends about, you know, 10 or 20
times. So what you're saying is that they've lent thousands of times more than they've actually got in deposits. So yes. If everybody tries to go and get their money at once, there's going to be nothing there.
Yeah, Goldman Sachs is very much part of the problem rather than part of the solution. And of course, the kind of people inside the loop, like Mark Carney, are not necessarily going to do anything which is going to rock the boat for those kind of people. I mean, that's the milieu they come from.
Yes, and Jason is going to be one of these people having to make the decisions in Bristol about where the axe falls.
No, he'll be the one taking the blame.
Contact with the Governor of the Bank of England, but
the axe will fall on the Governor of the Bank of England, did you say?
Well, I won't be coming in contact with the Governor of the Bank of England within my role. I might occasionally go to a conference with him, but no. What he has done in Canada is very interesting in that terms of shifting the bank's focus from a inflationary target to a growth target is something that could be quite interesting and could be something that does mean a fundamental shift in governance of how the bank is run. I'm not familiar with his other connections to the banking community. I can only judge them on this public record.
Banking community is a very polite way of putting it. Yeah.
Exactly.
It's more like a cult, I'd say. But anyway, Martin, and what about this idea of Carney? Do you think he's going to actually make any difference to them? Is he just the same cloth as Mervyn King?
Well, exactly. I mean, the options are relatively limited if you're going to work within the constraints that we've inherited from the previous bad decisions that have been taken.
I mean, Ed Balls was a strong supporter of him.
He's got wide support across the spectrum as a technocrat. But I mean, the problems aren't really technocratic. And the Labour Party, of course, doesn't want to actually be shouting from the rooftops, hey, this is actually a disastrous situation, because they want to run, they aspire to run it, so they don't in fact want to be talking it down. I'm not elected to anything, and I can say what I really think, which is I'm afraid there is going to be a crash. I think it's virtually inevitable, in my view.
What are your thoughts about the way this is going? Because if you look at the debt graphs, mm-hmm. I mean, we are going up at an incredible rate.
I think there's been
still
a recent rise in terms of the stock market.
Anything to do is just slightly, you know, be going up a slightly less incredible speed.
The government needs to do is return to growth. Once we can actually return to its process of economic growth, then we can actually grow the pension funds that pay people's pensions. We can also take the tax revenue that pay for the things that we need to actually have in a society. We will pay less in the benefits to the social security nets, which are a very fundamental part of civilized society. The debate is how we go about doing that. I think the points by the IMF, I would agree earlier that Osborne won't probably change anything as a result of what Lagarde has said for political reasons as much as anything else. There is a debate over capital spending, and I think the government may try and wangle some way that they can present that the capital spending that they are perhaps going to do was always part of the plan. Maybe we'll see something like that.
But one of the things that is going to be having to be decided at some point fairly soon is the residence parking zones here. Yeah. And this may be a great way to get some cash in because you're not getting enough from central government. But anyway, this week we saw in the Bristol Post pensioners staging a peasant's revolt over residence parking zones. Pensioners in Montpellier staged a mock peasant's revolt against Mayor George Ferguson and his plans to introduce residence parking zones. The group hoisted a symbolic pair of red trousers up high on a pitchfork in protest at the group, at the scheme, which they say is being rolled out without consultation. Now, Jason, this has been a bone of contention for years. It looks like the mayor, because he's a 4-year dictator anyway, is able to actually do something about it at last.
Sure.
What's your feelings about this?
I think we're having the debate simply because we do now have a directly elected mayor who has the power to do a scheme of this scale across the city. It's one of those things that has been talked about continually for a long time, but you would have always faced a cliff edge problem when you're rolling it out in only specific communities. For example, if you were to just do it in Clifton, you'd have everyone parking just down the road and just outside of the zone. So the scale of it is something that is new, and that's something that people are reacting to. The point about consultation, I think the consultation has now been extended. A very recent announcement has been said, and I don't think it was ever stated categorically how the system was going to work, just that this was going to be adopted and that it was now to debate how it was going to work.
I don't be rude, but it's not rocket science, a resident parking scheme. It's just a question of how much are people going to have to pay, maybe for the first car, the second
factors.
Car, the third car. And the worry is, which is happening in many other parts of the country, that they might come in with a fairly reasonable charge, but then every year this is just going to be a cash cow that the council, when they're strapped for cash, are just going to go, right, we're going to jack up resident parking rates.
On the first point, there are complicating factors where there is debate over businesses and things like that as to whether they should have citywide permits, and I think that's a good area of which should be expanded and looked at. on the terms of the cash cow, I don't think the funds being raised from this will be anywhere near the cash cow that people think it might be. Unfortunately, it might be a little bit above revenue neutral, but I don't think it's going to be a money spinner by any means.
Well, £30 per person per year to park one car, £80 for the second car, and businesses pay £100 for each parking permit.
Yes, but the administration, the regulation and everything else that goes into the building of these schemes and then the operating of them simply means that you don't end up with a cash cow at the end of it. If future governments, as you're saying, were to look at raising the prices of it, I think that's where you would run into issues over democratic mandate about doing that, and that would be something that people would then would have to vote on. And indeed, if people wanted this, if people want a huge investment in public transport, then that's one of the ways it could be funded, and that people could be given that choice.
Martin, resident parking schemes on the horizon 2014. Next year sometime.
Well, I mean, to be honest with you, I think this is the sort of thing that needs to be discussed with all concerned, and the widest possible consensus needs to be reached about it. Clearly some people are unhappy with the scheme as presented at the moment.
Isn't it just for many people who can only just about afford a car, it's just another thing that they can't afford? I mean, for example, they may then not be able to have a car. That means they're forced onto the buses. A lot of people find that the buses just aren't working for them, are either too expensive or don't go in the right direction or are not reliable enough. You've got energy prices, for example, they're going up. Here's something that you never had to pay in the past, and here's another bill that's going to be coming through the door.
The positive for residents, of course, is that people who are non-residents don't have, you know, you will be able to get a place to park. I mean, in parts of the city, it's quite difficult to get a place to park.
Yeah, but then you'll end up with a ticket.
But the point is, the residents then will have guaranteed parking, won't they?
Sure.
That's what they're paying for.
Sure. The other thing which is on the horizon, of course, is the congestion charge. Jason, what are your thoughts about that? Do you think that's going to, is it a runner?
Horizon as such, I think the man said that he's asked for an initial policy investigation about it. I cannot see that happening in the next, certainly in the next few years, 10 years perhaps. It's an interesting debate about how we handle public transport, and it's an interesting and responsible thing to be in the mix. Bristol is not London, so it would be very difficult to see how we would handle the changes that would need to be, and there would need to be vast improvements in public transport for a scheme like that to work. Not fundamentally against it, but it's just that as is, we would need big changes for that to be viable.
I mean, what about, for example, back to residence parking, what about, for example, if you're someone that is delivering around the city, you're maybe having to stop for, 10, 15 minutes at each location?
Well, this was my point about businesses, that there is a strong argument that businesses like plumbers and so forth do need a different type of permit in order to be able to carry out the jobs that they need to do in different areas. I think that's a different case to what the scheme is trying to tackle, which is commuters parking in the central suburbs and then coming into work. And in areas where there have been residence parking schemes, locally it's been very positive, and actually there are very good benefits to them. Actually, in other cities where they've been rolled out, the consensus afterwards is that they, on the whole, were a positive thing. And I do wonder whether 2-3 years down the line that we will actually be wondering what the debate was so fiercely about. We do have a couple of cases of councillors who were in favour of residence parking schemes. Now they're being brought in by the mayor, suddenly dancing on the head of a pin of the issue, because frankly, they can.
Well, we don't normally do this, but we will this week because of the sad death of Ray Manzarek, the piano player from The Doors. So we're going to have a bit of music, which we have to edit out afterwards from the podcast. But anyway, let's hear from The Doors now. Jim Morrison on the vocals, Ray Manzarek on keyboards there, and that's The Doors from 1967, from their first album. Martin, one thing you can't, on our show, you can't talk about The Doors without talking about Jim Morrison's father, George Morrison, George Stephen Morrison, who was a rear admiral in the US Navy and involved in the Gulf of Tonkin, because Jim famously said, when he was asked about his father, "My father is dead."
Yes, because he was ashamed of his father's role in the Gulf of Tonkin incident.
Well, what happened to Tonkin?
Well, the Gulf of Tonkin incident was a staged attack, effectively. That's what the history books seem to be saying now. The Americans pretended they'd been attacked by the North Vietnamese so that they could pass a resolution through Congress to declare war on Vietnam, which they did.
So he had this kind of weight on his shoulder, really, saying, my dad started the Vietnam War. No wonder he said that he was dead.
Yeah. It didn't, it made him an unhappy bunny.
Okay, well, on to back to the news now, and pensioners we had. Now it's on to the fate of hundreds in the Bristol area have been decided in secret courts. This is actually from a couple of weeks ago in the Post, by a story with by Louis Emmanuel. The fate of hundreds of vulnerable people in the Bristol area has been decided behind closed doors in secret courts. The Court of Protection, which operates around the country, makes decisions on behalf of people too ill to do so themselves. The Bristol Post has attempted to track cases through the courts, including one relating to an elderly person in care, but they're banned from releasing any details. The virtually inaccessible courtrooms are so secret, but not only is attendance prohibited, any media reporting is deemed an offence unless special permission is given. And the story goes on to say, after a member of Freedom of Information requests, we can reveal that over the last 3.5 years, Court of Protection has received 358 applications from Bristol City Council, South Gloucestershire, North Somerset and Bath and North East Somerset councils. In Bristol, 110 applications have been made, rising steadily until since 2010. North Somerset, the total is 119. South Gloucestershire, it's 79, while Baines, the number stands at 50. Bristol's the only local authority to have applied for deprivation of liberty orders, with all five being successful, leading to individuals being placed in care homes. Now, Jason, this doesn't sound to me very healthy, to have decisions being made about people's futures with complete secrecy, with no access to the court for press or public.
Not healthy is a very mild way of putting it. Yes, it's a very worrying state of affairs and can only be detrimental to the people's view of the law. It's very worrying, and it's a situation that I haven't known about before, and the Post deserves credit for actually pursuing the story with some vim here.
They certainly do, yeah.
And keeping going, really, to see what else is going on there and try and pull more of this into the open. Courts of law should be public wherever they're, and the process of law should be transparent. Frightening is the word that comes to mind.
Yeah, well, I agree with all of that. I think there may be a case for confidentiality in dealing with sensitive family matters. Family courts often do have confidentiality clauses, and there may be some justification there. But as a general principle, justice should be transparent, surely.
And also, of course, if these decisions are made and prove in some way controversial, it seems very strange to make sure that there's no access for press and public to that decision. Especially when you backtrack. Say, for example, somebody dies, if you can't actually backtrack how that decision was made, it's very, very difficult. Bristol City Council spent more than £100,000 of our money on these applications since 2011.
Well, yes, I mean, what can we say? I mean, the deprivation of liberty order sounds an extremely sinister thing, doesn't it?
Yeah, and most importantly, not to know about when these things are going on. Apparently, as well, is if you try and publicise something which they've said that you're not allowed to publicise, you too can be locked up for weeks, if not months. Jason?
It's only something that the media have a duty to explore, and I think we as citizens have a duty to ask our relevant representatives more about and understand why this is happening. As you rightly said, there are cases where, of course, anonymity and confidentiality must be adhered to, but as a general principle, the law must be as transparent as possible. And if we're moving in a direction where that isn't the case, then that can only be a bad thing.
Well, it's not just the Court of Protection, is it? Because we've had Ken Clark's proposal, in fact, it's now coming into law for secret courts, which the Lib Dems actually backed, even though the Lib Dem conference said they wanted to condemn it and stop it. The Lib Dem leadership decided no, they're going to go with it. And this is much more, Martin, to do with security issues, where people from the security services, intelligence officers, etc., are implicated in criminal offences. They will be able to then have the entire proceedings held in secret.
Indeed, and of course the real danger there is it's not just that innocent people may be convicted, it's that the intelligence services may get away with stuff and cover it up, and that's the danger.
I think the general principle that it's based on is probably more reasonable than what we fear it to be. It's a thin end of the wedge argument that protecting MI6 officers is a very valid thing to do, but it's when these courts then become a clearinghouse for
the current practice is that they can testify anonymously. So Brigadier Gordon Kerr, before he was named, was known as Colonel J.
Sure.
And he used to head up the Force Research Unit, and he was brought into court to testify and, in fact, to defend himself. He's actually, because he, of course, was what Chief Constable Stevens of then of Cambridgeshire Police said, this guy's a terrorist even though he's a colonel, and we're going to have to prosecute him, but he was let off.
It's part of a worrying trend, isn't it? Because we've also had the orders from ACPO, not from the Home Office, from ACPO seem to make most of the decisions to do with the police, not the Home Office, or Theresa May is kind of cut out of the loop. But this is to do with the naming of people who've been arrested. So somebody can be arrested, the family or somebody that knows them can contact the media then contact the police, can you confirm this person's been arrested? And then the police will say, no, we are not going to confirm they've been arrested at all. That again is one of those things where, you know, if you're backtracking, if something goes wrong, how do you know if the police refuse to tell you that somebody is in custody when it looks like they are? It means that basically it's very difficult to publicise the fact that that arrest has taken place. Jason,
again, it's only part of a worrying trend. I can't add any more to it than that it's I'm not actually familiar with what ACPO is, sorry.
The Association of Chief Police Officers.
Okay, right.
They have, I mean, literally for 20 years, maybe 30 years, there's been a sort of rivalry between the Home Office and ACPO as to who's really running
ACPO
the police.
ACPO is effectively a trade union of
but
chief
it's also
police officers.
A private limited company.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. It's not actually part of the state structure, although it does have considerable powers.
Yes, they both, what was happening in the 1980s and the winter of discontent and times like this, and of course the same now, is that the Home Office issues a whole list of guidance and instructions for the police, and then ACPO also issues a whole list of guidance and instructions for the police, and the police then are saying, well, actually, which one do we do, you know, in a certain set of circumstances. Martin.
Well, that's right. I mean, these things need, especially at the moment, with all the things that have been happening and all of this kind of war on terror hype and all the rest of it, people must be convinced that the law is being impartially enforced and that everybody's rights are being protected. It's fundamental.
All right, on to our next story. And Help to Buy puts mortgage market at risk, says Mervyn King. It's back to King Mervyn. I'm trying to do quite a bit about him before he disappears over the horizon. Martin, what are your thoughts about the Help to Buy initiative? Because this started in the budget, doesn't it? I mean, Mervyn King is saying it may be a bad thing. Yeah. I mean, some people are saying, of course, that it's nothing really to do with Help to Buy. It's Help to Sell. It's people like Prince Charles, who's built all these houses in Panbury that he can't sell at the price he wants to sell them. So this helps people to afford to buy one of Prince Charles's houses, even though maybe in the normal circumstances they couldn't.
Well, Mervyn King is quite right to point this out. I mean, whether he should do this as an independent Bank of England governor criticising government policy is another question.
I think he can do it as his final speech.
It's his final speech, yeah. I mean, he's right about this, because, in fact, effectively what they're trying to do is restart the property bubble, which got us into the mess in the first place. It's pointless, because in actual fact I don't think they can restart the property bubble with the economy and the state it's in. So, in other words, it won't in fact have the effect that they want it to have. But if it did work, all it would do is set the bubble off again so it can pop another time.
I think another way of referring to these types of mortgages is subprime mortgages.
Indeed, that's what they used to be called.
That's the technical term, and I think you might have heard of them somewhere before, and they didn't have such a great result. So,
well, the taxpayer will be on the hook if these mortgages go sour. I mean, is that wise? It's a distortion.
Sure.
Yeah, but I mean, we've had a real problem in the British economy for many decades, where people are much more willing to buy houses than they are to invest in businesses.
Sure.
And that's why our businesses are not so successful in international terms, but everybody's got very nice conservatories if they're wealthy enough.
And related to that, handing over public services to the banks. This is a summary of an article which was published in the New Internationalist, May the 15th. The private finance initiative is hitting taxpayers' images of money under a CC licence. There is a scandal unfolding quietly in Britain which poses an existential threat to our most critical public services. What he's essentially saying is that many of our PFI projects for hospitals and schools are going into the hands of the banks.
Well, it was the Conservative government that started the private finance initiative, and then the Labour government carried on with it. It's basically silly. It means borrowing money much more expensively than the government could borrow it. But what it means is it's not on the books,
yeah.
So that the government doesn't have to admit that it's borrowing
money. It's not classified as debt.
Yes, but at the same time, the debt in fact is worse than if they'd borrowed it directly.
It's a very expensive way of borrowing.
It's a silly way to do it.
Yeah, no, sure. Like,
so, Jason, the argument always used, though, is that, you know, we wouldn't have a new South Mead Hospital if it wasn't for this PFI.
I think the merits of the cases for PFI need to be looked at individually. Probably when the cases initially started, it was a new way of doing things in order to achieve schemes to happen. And then, like, well, an awful lot that happened between the mayor administration and major administration, rather, and then up to the present, all of these things kind of went on steroids to kind of keep the economy growing and pumping. It may well be that PFI needs to be reimagined, and we need to be a little bit more honest about how we want to fund our public services and how much they cost.
We've gone down that road, though. Martin, we've already 22 of the 103 NHS trusts to enter PFIs are facing financial difficulties due to exorbitant repayments. Some hospitals are having to hand over a fifth of their annual budget on paying for the deal. In education, it's revealed that we're due to have a shortfall of 250,000 school places for our children by 2014, while the taxpayers picked up a £70 million bill for the PFI schools, which had to close.
Well, yes, it's the economics of the madhouse, but we've had a whole generation of silly private sector good, public sector bad attitude. I think once we've had the crash, if we do have one, and I'm afraid that we're going to have one, then that will be shown to be completely wrong, and that in actual fact we're probably going to have to move to an economy which has probably got maybe 70% public sector and only 30% private sector. That's what we'll look like in 25 years' time.
Okay, that's quite a prediction. I think the private finance initiative probably needs to be reined back, and things need to be financed properly. Let's be more honest with the public about how the governments actually finance schemes like building hospitals and schools and things that the society wants, and then say the appropriate tax level that are needed to achieve it will be X, and then let's vote on it. The kind of smoke and mirrors accounting of the PFI is and now the resultant high interest rates are paying for it. It's akin to when you buy something on a credit card and never pay it back.
Well, what bothers me, Martin, just a second. What bothers me is you've got the head of finance and, of course, Ruth Brunt, who was the chair of the North Bristol NHS Trust, have left. So they've set the whole PFI thing on, and then they're off. Which I'd like to think that these senior management people are going to see it through, but
and
they
that
haven't.
May well have been the appeal of the PFI scheme to many of the people who set it up. Like in the major government, it was a way of doing it at the time, which was perhaps slightly short-termist in view of its consequences.
Staying with the health stuff, accident and emergency this week in the Commons, at the Commons Health Select Committee, we had the President of the Royal College of Emergency Medicine, Dr. Mike Clancy, speaking, followed by the Senior Registrar of the Royal College of Physicians, Dr. Pat Caddingham.
Working with a system that is at the limits of its tolerance. Organisations are now focusing more on how many people are waiting up to 12 hours and have, in a sense, parked the four-hour target because it's so difficult to manage. And I think that's a reflection of the pressure the system is under. There's a major workforce workload imbalances within emergency departments and an inability of the whole system at the moment to meet the demand.
What appears to have crippled the hospitals is at the same time there has been an increase in length of stay. And it just flow out of the emergency department that is one of the crippling factors. A&E is the recognisable brand, and that's where patients will go because they know they will see someone who is expert, will see them often within 4 hours, and they will receive treatment. Patients will go where the lights are on. In many of these alternatives, the lights are not on after 5 o'clock in the evening or at the weekends.
Well, that was the Senior Registrar at Royal College of Physicians, Dr. Pat Caddingham there. And before that, you heard from the President of the Royal College of Emergency Medicine, Dr. Mike Clancy, speaking at the Commons Health Select Committee. Jason Budd, Independent Councillor for King's Weston. This is really, really worrying. One of the first things the Coalition Government did 2 years ago was to get rid of the targets. Because they said, oh, we don't like this target culture. One of the first things they did was get rid of targets for A&E.
I think the problem stems back prior to that, the Labour administration, where they removed the necessity for GPs to have hours servicing. And I think the root has been bubbling away there. It's no one government can be fully laid blame on it. It seems to have been a culture change that people are going to A&E for more minor things. And presumably it's about, as the gentleman said, the lights being on there when people fear the lights aren't going to be on elsewhere, or that they're not going to be seen in time. Looking at where people, reimagining what ways that people use the service is probably the best place to start. I recall David Davis mentioned something about people being able to register with GP services nearer their place of work rather than their place of home. That might be something to consider as a way of increasing access to the NHS.
Martin, it does look as if many parts of the NHS are not delivering, and so when they don't deliver, people go to A&E.
Yes, and if what we might decide to do is say, well, people obviously like A&E, so let's chuck resources at it and make sure that it works, rather than getting... I mean, in a sense, they're a victim of their own success, aren't they? People go there because they know they're going to get what they expect. It's a one-stop shop, as it were.
Well, they aren't. I mean, they're looking at... Some places now are looking at 12-hour waits.
Well, that's what... In that case, you have to redirect... If we're going to go with A&E, you'd redirect resources to A&E.
But is this a manufactured crisis? I mean, is this something that you think is part of the attempt by the present administration in the health department, Jeremy Hunt, who used to be... culture, media and sport, to actually create a crisis in the health service so that they can then justify the privatisation and the changes, that they want?
The data's been going, showing that the A&E has been rising rates for much longer than he's been in the job, so I don't think that can be said. I think it is to do with a changing culture about how people are doing it. I don't think A&E is a place to go, for example, if your daughter has an ear infection or something like that. That, you know, that's no longer A&E, that's doing something else. If society wants it to do something else, that's great, but accident emergency should then be a different thing. We would all want it to be, if indeed we had just been in an accident or were we in a real emergency.
I think that's right, and I think the point you made about changing the doctor's contracts is a valid one. On the other hand, it was the Labour Party that did that, and the doctors were very happy because, junior doctors, as we all know, there's always been a long problem in the health service of particularly junior doctors just working ridiculous hours.
But this problem was allowed to build up, Martin, because taking away the targets 2 years ago.
Well, yes. I mean, the point is that targets are all very well, but they've got to be, you've got to recognise what the limits of targeting are, because everybody then works to the target and doesn't take any account of anything else, and that's always going to be the case.
Well, we've got another peculiar story this week. A peculiar story. Marks & Spencer's customers pay twice on their contactless payment cards, despite standing a foot from the till. Shoppers have been charged on their contactless cards without knowing. They are charged when simply standing next to the machines. Marks & Spencer's recently rolled out contactless payment in 644 of their shops. They said it knows of only 5 cases, but they have had a positive response. 250,000 transactions a week are now taking place in our stores, they say, on contactless payments. So, Jason, what about this? This is a bit of new technology, but it sounds like if you walk past the wrong till at the wrong time, suddenly, ping, money is just stolen. Am I allowed to say that? Stolen by Marks & Spencer's from your account.
Unintentionally taken.
I
confess to being a Luddite where this is concerned. I think I do have a touch payment card and I've not used it, so it's a piece of technology that I haven't quite come accustomed yet. It's very new. Obviously there's going to be some teething problems with it. A lot of people didn't like chip and pin when that first came in, and now that's...
I still don't.
Well, a lot of people have adjusted to it being there. In these cases, there's nothing insidious going on there. It just seems to be something to do with the sensors that's picking up the two things within that. I think there's been a problem in London as well, where Oyster cards have had a similar thing.
As technology moves into the world of money, sure, haven't we seen time and time again problems? Because you've got...
You always have teething problems with these things.
But they're not...
Standing in queues for the till. And
what about the cash points, though? Because they weren't teething problems. They were fine for about 30 years. And the last 6 or 8 months, we keep getting these problems where people are having money taken from their accounts, or they come and find that there's nothing in their account when there should be money there. And all sorts of... I mean, technology, Martin, it seems to me, and financial transactions, we need to be very, very careful the way we manage this.
Well, in the Corralito in Argentina in the early 2000s, people turned up to the bank to get their money out and found that the ATMs were just off, and they lost all their money. The middle class basically lost.
Where is this? Where are you talking
Argentina
about? In Argentina.
And that's what happens when you have a crash. And if we have a crash, that's may very
well
be.
Don't think the crash is going to come as a result of Marks and Spencer's
No, it's not. No, it's not. But I mean, what the, you know, when they said in 2008, if we don't bail the banks out, the ATMs are going to close. That is what happened.
Well, it very nearly did happen. If Bank of America hadn't bought up what remained of Merrill Lynch, then the ATMs very nearly were going to close all over the world. And that's the view of Hank Paulson, who was.
But we've now got into a situation where we've bailed them out in order to avoid a crash.
Zombie banks.
Yes, exactly. That is the. I mean, what should have been happening?
Martin, you have to stop you there. Well, you can tell us some other time what should have been happening, because it's time for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. Thanks very much to this week's guest. That was Ashley Ward, candidate in the recent local elections. Oh no, it wasn't. Kings Weston. Jason Budd, the Independent. After the news, we're talking about the Bilderberg Fringe Festival.
Award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.